Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of September. The complicated story of Somalia, this hour of the program with Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy is from Milwaukee, and he is really a wonderful investigative reporter. He's Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute and a frequent contributor to The Nation. He's the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, award-winning investigative journalist and correspondent for the national radio and TV program Democracy Now. He's written two lengthy and thorough pieces on the CIA's secret sites in Somalia that appeared in The Nation quite recently, and Jeremy was in Somalia in late June and July. He writes in the first piece, the CIA's secret sites in Somalia, nestled in a back corner of Mogadishu's Adan Ade International Airport, sprawling walled compound run by the CIA. The CIA has its own aircraft at the airport. The CIA runs a counterterrorism training program for Somalia intelligence agents and operatives aimed at building an indigenous strike force capable of snatch operations and targeted combat operations against members of al-Shabaab, an Islamic militant group with close ties to al-Qaeda. As in all things involved here in the war in Iraq and the war in al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, there are lots of twists and turns in this story. The CIA, he writes, is reluctant to deal directly with Somali political leaders regarded as corrupt and untrustworthy. Instead, Somali intelligence agents are on its payroll, receiving $200 monthly cash payments from Americans. He speaks with many of the warlords, and he outlines what's been happening since the drought and famine grabbed international headlines, of course, in July. So he will also speak to that. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jeremy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at The Kathleen Dunn Show. And I'm reminded by my young producers that we can also be followed at Twitter at K Dunn Show. All right, we're with it. We're in 2011. Hour number two of our show, Calvin Trillin, will be with us. A wonderful book of his 40 years of writing has just been released, and we'll have a lot of fun with him. Jeremy, hello. How are you?
Kathleen, I'm impressed with your mastery of the Twitter language.
You are? Did I say it right?
You did. My mom is on Twitter also, and she's a tweet maniac.
Your mom is?
Yes, she is. Well, my dad is not, although he sometimes hijacks her Twitter account.
Well, I guess you'd have to be a Twitter person to be following your son, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Who knows where you're going to be next or what you're going to uncover. You were in Somalia, which was a fairly dangerous place to be in June and July. Just tell me about your getting there. Was it difficult? Was it an overwhelming journey?
Yeah, I mean, I spent about 3 months just working out the security arrangements for going into Somalia. And in fact, you know, we had two or three plans that we thought made sense and were, you know, you can't really use the word safe and Mogadishu in the same sentence, but we thought that they were reasonable risks for journalists to take to get a story. And when we started talking more with colleagues that had spent time there and people from international organizations, we had to scrap numerous plans before we went in. And eventually, we found an extremely trustworthy, brave Somali contact who arranged this incredible security for us. And you have to travel very discreetly to go in there. On the one hand, the perception of a white guy in Somalia may be that he is CIA, and in which case you could be a target. Or on the other hand, you're worth about $4 million to kidnappers. And there have been journalists and aid workers that have been kidnapped. So we had to really, I've never worked so meticulously on a security plan for anywhere I've gone before. And I have to say that, you know, Mogadishu makes Kabul look like Disneyland. I mean, just the sheer number of guns, the various militias on the streets, the place is just, it looks like, you know, like I would imagine some bombed out city, you know, from World War II or the hand-to-hand combat of World War I. I mean, it literally exists in a different era in human history and hasn't developed or grown since it last had a government in 1991. And it's just, it's a shockingly hellish place to be.
And I would imagine you were meeting and you outlined so thoroughly all of the various warlords that you met with, and a lot of those people were targets for other groups as well. So everywhere you went, somebody was either suspicious of you or out for the person you were talking to.
Yeah, I mean, we traveled with one of the most notorious warlords, and I write extensively about him in one of the stories you mentioned, named Indaade. And he's been a player on the warlord scene since the 1990s and has switched sides multiple times, and currently he's fighting on the side of the U.S. and the Somali government, fighting against the al-Shabaab militants that you mentioned. But just 5 years ago, he was harboring those same individuals that he's now fighting and shielding them from the CIA grabbing them or the Somali government, taking them out. And when we were traveling with him one afternoon, we were near the Bakara Market, which was the site of the famous Black Hawk Down incident in the early 1990s when the U.S. helicopters were shot down and the Army Rangers were killed and dragged through the streets. And we were sort of walking with him along these trenches that had once been occupied by the Islamic militants from al-Shabaab. And we see a foot poking out from below this sand that had sort of been loosely dumped over his body. It was a makeshift grave. And I asked Indaade who the body was of, and he said it was a foreign fighter from Shabaab. And he said that if they capture foreigners fighting with their Somali colleagues from al-Shabaab, they execute them on the battlefield. But that the Somalis they capture, they'll treat them better and hand them over. I mean, this is a guy who is being funded by the U.S.-backed African Union forces, and he's openly bragging to a Western journalist about executing prisoners on the battlefield. Shortly after we left that position, one of his commanders that we had talked to was shot in the head and killed.
Oh my.
In the place that we had just been. So, I mean, that and a very narrow miss that we had of an improvised explosive device that ended up killing about a dozen university students in Mogadishu just really brought home the horror that Somalis are forced to live with every day. Random bullets, Kathleen, are flying sometimes from more than a mile away and hitting people that have nothing to do with what was going on in the area where the bullets were fired. One night in the home we were staying at, in the courtyard, a bullet just came flying in and hit the back of a chair that someone was sitting in. And it wasn't a targeted, shot. No one was trying to kill that person. It was that a bullet had just flown from, some distance away. And it's particularly horrible when you see children walking around with one leg or having some kind of makeshift crutches because they've had parts of their bodies blown off. Oftentimes they weren't the target of anything. It's the randomness of violence and what happens when a society is in an absolute free fall, and that's Somalia to the core.
You were there when we just started to get these reports of the massive famine. Can you address that before we talk about what's going on with the CIA? Did you see massive numbers of people leaving? And can you tell us why it is so hard to get food distributed to those starving people?
Well, there's a couple things I would say about that. The first is that when we first flew into East Africa, we landed in Nairobi, Kenya, and then we drove down, about 8 hours or so it took us, from Nairobi to the Kenya-Somalia border, which is the site of the Dadaab refugee camp, which is the largest refugee camp in the world. And there are approximately 400,000 people living in a camp that was originally built for 90,000. So you can just imagine the conditions there, the sanitation conditions, the desperation for food. It's a horribly chaotic hellhole that these people are forced to live in. And many of these people fled the violence that has been taking place for the past 20 years in Somalia. They've come in different waves. But then on the outskirts of that camp, you have literally thousands of people who have set up these sort of shanty towns hoping that they can get into the hellish refugee camp. So they're living in even worse conditions. And when we arrived there, the thing that stood out to me the most was there were beggars on the sides of the roads, and they didn't want money. They were asking if we had spare water. And the Somalis that we were with were tossing them, half-consumed bottles of water, and people would just guzzle it down. There was this incredible drought in this kind of barren wasteland, and you saw, animal carcasses rotting all over. Mm. And then we saw the beginnings of the recent exodus when we crossed into Somalia across that border, people carrying everything that they could. The problem of the famine is it's very complicated to discuss why this is happening. I think think it's a combination of the political instability in Somalia, the fact that there's been a raging war for 20 years, but also the consequences of that instability. One of the main consequences is that there are no systems developed to save water when it does rain, or to create a system where you have consistently potable water. And the war has also wiped out the ability of Somalia to take advantage of its rich soil and natural resources and continue to be a self-sustaining society. That combined with the fact that the U.S. Has basically banned, up until very recently, the distribution of aid in areas of Somalia controlled by the al-Shabaab, al-Qaeda forces, and those are the areas that are suffering the most, I think have all come together to create just a horrifying humanitarian catastrophe. And I do think it could have been prevented, and it would have required a lot of work on various sides, including the Shabaab militants, who are criminals and thugs, and they deserve a large part of the blame for this also. But it's also a failure on the part of the U.S. and its allies, who claim to be about helping Somalia. They just have failed Somalia miserably for 20 years.
You must have come home just devastated.
Well, you know, I can't lie to you. I mean, when I got back from Mogadishu and arrived back in Nairobi, which, you know, Nairobi seemed like like being in some kind of a regal, you know, mansion somewhere compared to being in Mogadishu, and arrived back in Nairobi, I found that I was having a lot of trouble being out after dark, even in Nairobi. I was still sort of shell shocked from all of the gunfire and the mortar explosions, and just constantly seeing men with guns and being, you know, worried that you're going to get shot by a random bullet or that someone's going to try to do a snatch operation against you. And, you know, the thing that has stuck with me the most, and I apologize for such a graphic story at such an early hour, but when this improvised explosive device exploded that I mentioned earlier, it was right near the scene of the former U.S. Embassy, which is now a huge camp for internally displaced people. It's not run particularly by anyone. It's just a camp that people have set up, and they've built tents there. And this bomb was targeting an African Union convoy, but it didn't detonate on time, and it blew up a bus full of university students. And we had just been there, and as we were driving back to our compound, our Somali colleague got a call that this explosion had just happened, and they knew that we were in that area, so his friend was making sure we were okay. And we then went to the hospital, where there are only four surgeons at a hospital that has 95% of the patients at it are people that have been shot by a gun or have shrapnel or mortar injuries, and a lot of them very serious. They have four surgeons at that hospital, and it's teeming with people just caked in blood or on their last breaths of life. And those doctors are extremely heroic, and we spent a lot of time with them at Medina Hospital, the only trauma hospital in Mogadishu, a city of 8 million people. And so we were following families around as they tried to figure out what happened to their loved ones. And at one point, we went to the morgue as reporters to try to get a count at the number of people that were killed. And there were family members outside of the morgue waiting to see if their loved ones were killed. And there was almost like a mini riot there, because they were so angry that they weren't getting answers and terrified that their loved ones were killed. So we got locked inside the morgue because the morticians were afraid to let us out, that people might be angry and take out their aggression on anyone, and it would have been understandable that they could get their hands on. But I was stuck then in that morgue with four bodies, one of which was,
oh, Jeremy,
had the head completely blown off except for a nose and part of a mouth. And the reason that I'm telling you that is not to, you know, make listeners disgusted. It's because that's the human face of terrorism and wars that could have been prevented. It's decapitated people, it's limbless children, it's hospitals that only have four surgeons because everyone who has a degree is fleeing that country to try to go somewhere to build a better life for their family. And that's the memory that haunts me the most and remains with me. And it also is what motivates me to try to beg people to pay attention to what's happening in Somalia, because it didn't need to be this way and it doesn't need to be this way.
It's why you went there. It's why you did such a risky thing to write these thorough stories. Well, my Jeremy, I'm glad you're talking to us today. Let's talk about the CIA. You start one of the articles by talking about this sprawling walled compound run by the CIA. What is the CIA's presence plan in Somalia? How many people do we have there? What's our goal?
Yeah, it's unclear exactly how many people we have, because it rotates a lot, and it's probably the most dangerous place in the world for the CIA to operate, because they will completely stand out anywhere that they go. So they've had to kind of create a fortified structure at really the only safe place in Mogadishu, and that is the airport, because it has a massive perimeter. It's backed up by thousands of African Union forces, and you know, I would love to tell you that I'm some kind of master sleuth who tracked down this CIA base, but the truth is we landed in Mogadishu, and we saw this brand new structure that looked to me and my colleague Rick Rowley, who has spent a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan, like a forward operating base that we'd seen elsewhere in the world since the, you know, since 9/11, and so we started asking, you know, what that structure was. It looked brand new, and everyone from the sort of kids selling cot, the leaf that people chew there, the sort of drug that the whole city's addicted to, they're like, oh yeah, that's CIA. And then we would ask, you know, a warlord, oh yeah, that's the CIA. And finally, then I started talking to Somali intelligence officials, and they said, yeah, about 4 months ago, the CIA finished construction on this base, and they're using that base to train an indigenous Somali strike force, they're sort of doing not behind the back of the Somali government, but without any say or cooperation from the U.S.-recognized government of Somalia. And so it's sort of twofold. On the one hand, the U.S. is training this force, and they haven't really been successful at doing much of anything thus far, except gathering intelligence through wiretaps and other things. But the flip side of it, the other part, which I think is more inflammatory, is that the CIA is utilizing a prison that is underneath Somalia's National Security Agency's headquarters, right behind the president's compound. And in this prison, there are over 100 people being held with allegations that they are either al-Shabaab or al-Qaeda operatives or have been giving support to them. And the CIA is technically not in control of that facility, Kathleen, but they're paying the salaries of everyone that works there, and they freely interrogate the prisoners that are being held in this underground prison, which is infested with bed bugs, has no natural light. One former prisoner described to me prisoners literally losing their minds, sitting against walls, banging their heads on the walls. One prisoner who inexplicably is just collecting every plate that's ever brought down there for a meal. And they're held without due process, without access to the Red Cross. When I spoke to the Red Cross, they said they weren't even aware of the facility. This to me was evidence that while President Obama did take office claiming that he wanted to dismantle the most outrageous and egregious components of the Bush counterterror policy, they found other ways to essentially continue the same policy while trying to legalize it more. And when I spoke to the U.S. government, they won't allow me to identify who they made available to talk to me. They said I could only say a U.S. official, but needless to say, it was someone who's deeply familiar with the Somalia operations. They sort of acted like, what's the big deal here? These are terrorists, and of course, we want to have access to them.
And who are the people who are there? Are there people who are being held there, much as in Guantanamo, who may just be innocent farmers who are in the wrong place at the wrong time?
You know, I don't know is the honest answer to that. If people there are, you know, innocent of why they were originally picked up, of the charges against them. I mean, none of them have been officially charged with anything. What I do know is that they're being held in contravention of international conventions and norms, and with no regard for the laws of war, because Somalia, you know, the U.S. doesn't have a declaration of war against Somalia, and I think that the CIA and the U.S. Special Operations Forces are taking advantage of the, you know, what might be called the gray zone. I do know, though, to directly answer your question about farmers and others, among the people that have been held in this hellish prison are journalists who were arrested simply for filming something the government didn't want filmed. And they've taken them there and put them in there and held them for, you know, 3 days or a week with all of these other people that are allegedly hardened terrorists, and have told them basically, if you keep doing this, you're going to be put back in this place. So what I do know for a fact is that it has been used as an intimidation tool against Somali journalists who are very brave, and many have been killed, and no one ever talks about it, and they've been put in this prison that is being funded by the U.S. So that in and of itself, for people like you and I who are in media, that is a scandal. As far as sort of innocent people that are not journalists that are being picked up, I don't know. I do know that the one prisoner that I reported on there who was rendered, who was snatched from the Somali slum in Nairobi called Eastleigh and then taken to Somalia, the U.S. official I spoke to told me that he was indeed a terrorist and that he had been the deputy to one of the people the U.S. believed was involved with the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. So, you know, the U.S. alleges that the people that are being held there are there for a reason, and the reason is connections to terrorism. So, yes, some innocent people I can document were there, such as journalists. The vast majority of them, we have no idea because no one's allowed into the prison.
We're going to go to phone calls in a moment, but before we do that, Jeremy, let's get to the meat of this, too, as far as the U.S. is concerned. You say in the article, U.S. policy has strengthened the hand of the very groups it purports to oppose and inadvertently aided the rise of militant groups, including the Shabab. Give us details.
Well, you know, after the Black Hawk Down incident happened, which was preceded by the last stable government of Somalia, of Siad Barre, being overthrown in 1991, then you had the U.S. go in and try to engage in a humanitarian operation to bring food and to try to unseat this warlord, Mohamed Farah Aidid, and it was the attempt to kill him that resulted in the choppers being shot down and the U.S. pulling out of Somalia. For the next 10 years, then, warlords just destroyed the country, declared their own fiefdom, and said, we're in charge of this area. And that was much of the 1990s. Then 9/11 happens, and the U.S., the Bush administration, had early on planned to go into Somalia. But saner heads prevailed. Former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia David Shin and others said it would be a terrible idea, and there's not really a substantial Islamic militant threat there. And so what the U.S. did instead was to fund a proxy force, essentially rent some of those very warlords that were destroying Mogadishu, and basically gave them lists of people that the U.S. believed to be Islamic militants to hunt down. And I interviewed Mohamed Kanyare, the main CIA warlord, who described to me, U.S. intelligence officials giving him photos of people and sort of doing a wink, wink, nod, nod, we'd like this guy to not be around anymore. And so these warlords from 2002 to 2006 were just terrorizing the population. Somalia is a 100% Muslim country, and there were allegations that they were killing imams, prayer leaders, Islamic teachers, targeting all sorts of people that had nothing to do with terrorism, along with people that did, the handful that did. And so that policy on the U.S. resulted in a group of individuals calling themselves Islamic courts coming together and setting up regional justice systems based on Sharia law. In 2006, then, those courts, in response to the U.S. warlords, form what was called the Islamic Courts Union, a united front, and they're funded by every businessman in Mogadishu because everyone hated the CIA warlords, and they immediately run the warlords out of town, and they declare Somalia to be under the governance of the Islamic Courts Union. The U.S. erroneously saw the Islamic Courts Union as an al-Qaeda force taking power in an African capital and determined to overthrow that government. The fact was, as is often the case when we talk about counterterrorism and terrorism, it was far more gray than that. There were a lot of people within that Islamic Courts Union who were not radicals and were far more Somali than they were anything else having to do with al-Qaeda. And the U.S. took out the very people that had, for the first time in 16 years, stabilized Mogadishu. And instead of engaging them and trying to determine who's a moderate among them, who can we talk to, they backed a massive invasion by Ethiopia, 40 to 50,000 Ethiopian troops. Ethiopia and Somalia, sworn enemies for decades and decades. The Ethiopians come in and dismantle that government, and that gave rise to the least powerful of the Islamic forces in Somalia, the Shabab, to become the vanguard in the jihad against the U.S. crusaders and their Ethiopian proxies. And it made them way more powerful than they ever would have been because they would have been kept in check by the other members of the Islamic Courts Union. So in short, Kathleen, what the U.S. did was to back heinous warlords who terrorized the population, sparking a group of Islamic leaders to come together, push them out, and then the U.S. overthrows them, making the very extremists, the handful of extremists they wanted to target, the vanguard, and gave them a tremendous recruitment and propaganda, ammunition for a tremendous recruitment and propaganda campaign, to the point where the Shabab, 3 years after that overthrow of the Islamic Courts government, controlled 40% of Somalia. I mean, it was incredible blowback, and it defines everything that's happening today.
How did we read the Islamic Courts Union so wrong?
Well, I think we weren't. I mean, like so much of what happened under the Bush administration, and this was certainly played out with the Iraq situation, where you had Dick Cheney going and Scooter Libby going to the CIA repeatedly and trying to change the conclusions of U.S. intelligence. I think that the hawks within the administration saw what they wanted to see. They cherry-picked individuals from the Islamic Courts Union and made them the definition of the entire Islamic Courts Union. Was there an al-Qaeda presence within the Islamic Courts Union? Absolutely. Was it more than a dozen people? Probably not. The Shabab could have gone either way. They're Somali first. And because the Islamic Courts Union was destroyed and then later co-opted by the U.S., the Shabab said, we're going to continue on this fight. And so they recruited all of these young people. The U.S. misread it because they didn't listen to their own experts. And they viewed it as purely through the lens of a military operation and counterterrorism as defined by the Bush doctrine of the world as a battle zone or a battlefield, and didn't listen to the people that had spent their careers working on Somalia. And I think that was one of the huge, if we had to pinpoint where many of the greatest disasters of the past 10 years of U.S. foreign policy came from, it was from not listening to people who actually knew what they were talking about and viewing it through a very narrow lens of, you know, Islamic terrorists want to destroy the world, and so we need to destroy them at any cost.
Jeremy Scahill is our guest this hour. He's written two extensive, enlightening pieces in The Nation on Somalia. He was there, as you heard him talk about, in late June and in early July. Jeremy is from Milwaukee originally. He's one heck of an investigative journalist. He works for The Nation and Democracy Now!, and he is the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Our phone number, our lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind, and we hope you can get through. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. We'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Calvin Trillin, our guest, hour number two of our show this Thursday. He is the author, well, he's the author of so much after 40 years. His compilation of writings just released in Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin, 40 years of funny stuff. Jeremy Scahill, our guest this hour. We start our calls with Wanda in Middleton. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, dear. I just love you guys both for the good you do in different fields. This is just another example of horrible, horrible things taking place, sometimes because of our government, sometimes not because of our government, but maybe. I think that all the issues are so complicated that we face now with the economy and all the blood and the gore in the world. You got to make a division between good and evil, and we got to see here that all these weapons poured in from, I mean, U.S.'s, all these weapons companies pouring into all these different places is causing death and destruction and evil. And couldn't the president do something like buy the weapons in Mogadishu and anywhere else that there's war? And couldn't they buy them from the government? The government buy the weapons from the weapon makers instead of letting them make the goddamn weapons. I'm sorry for that language, but this is so upsetting. Instead of letting them make the weapons, let them make something like plowshares, pruning hooks.
Yeah, well, the plowshare and pruning hooks industry, is not nearly as lucrative as the war industry, unfortunately. And I appreciate your sentiment and your emotion. I hate to depress you even further, but what's actually happening in Mogadishu is that the weapons that the U.S. is paying for and sending there to this, 8,000 member African Union quote unquote peacekeeping force that's there, many of those weapons have ended up on the black market. And actually have been purchased by the al-Shabaab militants. I also saw warlords getting shipments of U.S. munitions from the African Union forces. So rather than buying back the weapons, and I know that that's a program that, cities across the United States, they've tried to have an amnesty where people can buy back weapons, and that's worked in some capacity in other conflict zones. As of now, the U.S. is going full steam ahead with amplifying the war by pouring in more and more weapons to various forces. Some of them are warlords, some of them are foreign peacekeeping forces, and as I say, some of them end up on the black market, as was described in the recent UN monitoring group report on Somalia. I mean, it's a real scandal that U.S. money is ending up in weapons getting into the hands of the very people that we claim to be fighting. So it's there is not much optimism that can be embraced around the Somalia situation.
Tell me more about the African Union, who they are, what their role is, Jeremy.
This to me is one of the sort of incredible underreported stories of the so-called war on terror. What the U.S. basically did, I mentioned that the Ethiopians invaded Somalia in late 2006, early 2007, and the U.S. was sort of using them as a proxy force. And when it became untenable for the Ethiopians to stay in Somalia because they were so widely reviled by Somalis of all political stripes and clan divisions, the U.S. began to aggressively fund the Ugandan government and also the Burundian government, while simultaneously setting up a fairly secret U.S. base in the nation of Djibouti, which also borders Somalia. And so you had a U.S. presence in Djibouti under the banner of AFRICOM, which is the U.S. African Command, which was a new command created under President Bush to target primarily East Africa, but also elsewhere in Africa. And then they start funding various militaries that they could use as proxy forces under the banner of peacekeeping in Somalia and Congo and elsewhere. And Uganda has sort of emerged as the most powerful of the African nations being backed by the U.S. on a military level. The greatest number of mercenaries or contractors, whatever word you choose to use, in Iraq right now, for instance, are Ugandans. And Uganda and the U.S. have a very close relationship militarily. And so when the Ethiopians left Somalia in 2009, the U.S. backed the Ugandan military, taking the lead in what was originally envisioned as a 10 to 12,000 member African Union peacekeeping force. The Ugandans are all trained by the U.S. They're completely equipped by the U.S. and armed and funded. And so they are essentially an African proxy force for the U.S. because the U.S. doesn't want to send its own soldiers into Somalia because of what, you know, it's still a relic of what happened with Black Hawk Down. So you know, the African Union peacekeeping force called AMISOM is really a U.S. creation. And the Ugandans have been the greatest beneficiaries of it. And, you know, when I met Ugandan soldiers in the field, they had the exact demeanor of U.S. soldiers. Many of them were telling me the places they'd trained in the United States. So, you know, it's very similar to the way that the Reagan and Bush the father administrations ran their secretive wars in Central America and elsewhere, where you're having a small footprint of U.S. personnel alongside a large footprint of what is essentially a proxy force operating at your direction.
Wanda, thanks for the call. Mark in Richland Center. Hi.
Good morning. This is relatively depressing, but you spoke about the American finance entities that are financing the weapons industry. Is this whole thing in Somalia, what is it about? Is it about just financing war for its profit unto itself, or is it about control of resources plus the lucrative nature of inhumane people just financing war? There seems to be no core definition so far as to why this whole thing is going on.
That's a good question.
It's relatively cynical, the fact that the banking industry finances all of it.
Yeah. I mean, I, just to be honest, I don't pretend to understand what the U.S. strategy is in Somalia. What I can tell you is what I've learned from my reporting, from talking to U.S. officials, and from being on the ground and studying this extensively for a number of years. I think U.S. policy, at best, the most benign way of characterizing it, is it has been utterly confused and also a violent, bloody contradiction, where you have policy people on the one hand advocating for diplomatic solutions to try to address what is increasingly becoming a terrorist threat, but wasn't, and it became a terrorist threat in East Africa, largely because of U.S. policy and the involvement of Somalia's neighbors for their own reasons to want to go into Somalia. I don't believe that the U.S. is engaged in Somalia just to benefit the weapons industry. I think that there are people that actually believe that Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab in East Africa represents the greatest regional threat in the world right now to U.S. interests. and the question of U.S. interest is a whole other show of what how you define that. The way that they've chosen to do it is at times to back proxy forces, at times to pull out completely. Both of those things have exacerbated the problem rather than helped it. I do think when you talk about resources, I don't necessarily think the U.S. has its eye on the resources of Somalia. Somalia does have tremendous natural resources, the longest coastline in Africa, the fishing industry off the coast. If you want to talk about the pirate situation, that's fascinating. But I think that the U.S. is backing countries in Africa that are being used in Somalia that have their own agenda and that benefit tremendously from Somalia remaining unstable. Kenya, for instance, benefits tremendously from the instability in Somalia because they raise tremendous amounts of money for the quote-unquote refugee problem. And so there's a really cynical, sick way in which the Kenyan government probably doesn't want Somalia to be stabilized because they make a tremendous amount of money off of it. All of these aid organizations with people with six-figure salaries and nannies live in Nairobi, Kenya, in plush apartments, and never step foot in Somalia, but they're Somalia experts. They're the ones that are going to save Somalia. They never step foot in the country. There's a Somalia industrial, you know, a Somalia crisis industry that benefits off of this. And it goes from the UN all the way down to the regional governments and the weapons industry, certainly.
Mm. Jeremy, the more you talk, this is one of those conversations that you kind of feel in the pit of your stomach that it's just sickening. It's horrible. And you got to try to find some light, something. Is there anything, or is it just hell?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that I have taken some heart in recently is that people, for the first time since the early 90s, actually paid attention to Somalia. And I think that we have to capitalize on this moment to not just make it a story about starving Africans or a famine in Africa, because people feel like they already know that story. They saw the images of the Ethiopian kid with the bloated stomach, and, oh, it's Africa, there's always this stuff. This should be one of the premier foreign policy discussions that we're having, what's happening in East Africa. It's a rapidly growing population all throughout East Africa. It is increasingly a Muslim population, even in countries like Kenya and Ethiopia. The Muslim population is growing at a far greater rate than any other sectors of those societies. And I think that if we don't step in and take a serious look at Somalia and how to address what's happening there, it's going to come back and bite us in a major way. So I do take heart that there are people paying attention to Somalia because of the horrendous humanitarian situation there. But to me, it's a wake-up call to actually study that history and figure and get some of our smartest people on this and not have the military and CIA be taking the lead on Somalia. We need to have people that actually have studied the culture and history there, because there is a way that the clan politics in Somalia could resolve this issue. But they are trumped by Islamic militants on the one hand and a horribly misguided U.S. counterterrorism policy on the other.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mark, for the call. Here's an email from Chris in Eau Claire that I thought you ought to hear, Jeremy. Mr. Scahill spoke at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire last year, and it blew my mind. I'll never forget his parting advice to the student body, just give a damn. It still resonates in my head.
Well, I think that's true of all of us. I mean, I spent some time there at Eau Claire with, you know, journalism students, and I was actually really inspired by how many of them seemed to want to get into a world where media actually matters, and it's not just about what Paris Hilton is doing or what disorder Lindsay Lohan has next week, but actually, you know, that they operate from their heart, and you have to be factually correct, but no, don't ever let anyone tell you that you can't have passion, that you can't believe in something, that you can't have a perspective. And it's not just about journalists, it's all of us. I mean, look at the horrible state we're in this country with our economic situation. I mean, in Wisconsin, you know it better than anyone else. My parents live two blocks from Scott Walker, and you know that block is lined with signs that say Recall Walker. It's tremendous to see how people do come together when they're pushed against a wall, and I just wish that we could take that same spirit and apply it to our foreign policy. We're almost spiritually dead when it comes to realizing the impact that our policies have on the rest of the world. And part of it is because we're suffering so badly at home. People can't struggle for a more just world when they're just struggling to put food on the table for their family every night. And that's one of the consequences. I think part of why we saw a sort of disappearance of any anti-war movement in this country to speak of was because people were beaten down. They were depressed and felt like they had just been rolled over. And then they got hit with horrible economic problems. And I think that, you know, we have to take a humility pill sometimes, those of us that believe in fighting for justice, and realize that people have to get their families, you know, have to get food in their kids' stomachs before they can be on the front lines of any kind of a struggle.
Antonio in Madison, hi.
Hello. I agree with you much on that. I was born in Salamanca in Spain, and I came here to this country, and I've been living here for 41 years, and I just realize how ignorant America is right now. They don't have a clue. We don't have a clue. I should say we. We don't have a clue how people in other parts of the world live.
Well, I mean, I think that's true. But I also think you can travel in, you know, communities across the United States that, you know, in part look like Mogadishu. I mean, you know, I was in Detroit not too long ago, and I mean, parts of Detroit look like absolute war zones. And you know, I mean, we have extremely serious situations in our country as well, where we live in what proclaims itself the most advanced society the world's ever known, and yet I can walk around New York and see people begging on the streets. You can go to slums across the United States and see people living in what are effectively, you know, urban war zones in the United States. And I mean, it's the point I'm trying to make is that I think that you know, part of the struggle of trying to build a more just world becomes infinitely harder when you're struggling just to keep your own head afloat. And that I mean, as an American, my biggest concern right now is the way we have totally abandoned the poor and are crushing the working class. To me, that's the premier issue of our domestic day. Internationally, we need to stop these wars that are going to result in blowback and are draining our treasury. I mean, that's me speaking as an American. As a citizen of the world, I want these wars to stop because I don't think that they're making us safer. And I think a lot of them are unjust. But as an American, what the hell are we spending all this money for when our people are suffering so badly?
Thanks, Antonio. June in Toronto. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Jeremy. You've answered my question about Ethiopia so well and so thoroughly. You went into Uganda and all the other concerns I have. And so I'm just going to say thank you for all you've done in so many areas, and every word is a message. Thanks.
Well, thank you for that.
Thanks very much for the call. Andre in Clintonville. Hi, Andre.
How are you doing this morning?
All right, how are you?
Oh, not too bad. I have a question. I agree with the caller before the lady, and I agree with your guest. But why isn't our government funding us? Why aren't they spending money in this country instead of funding so many secret wars when we could be rebuilding our construction zones, our infrastructure, building bridges, redoing schools? All this money is going overseas secretly to fund all these wars when we're the ones that are suffering. We're not trying to fix what's on our side of the fence. We're trying to fix what's on the side of somebody else's fence. We don't need to know what's going on in their backyard. We can clearly see what's going on over there, but we don't see what's going on in our own backyard. Why are people paying attention to our own politicians and making them do their jobs correctly?
I would imagine that a lot of people listening, particularly in Wisconsin, would agree wholeheartedly with what you said. You know, one sort of nuance to it, though, you know, we're spending about $9 billion a month on the war in Afghanistan. And, you know, I punished myself by watching the Republican debate the other night on CNN. But it was interesting to note, you know, Rick Perry calling for, you know, U.S. troops to come out of Afghanistan. I think that, you know, there are people on the right that are sort of starting to realize what a lot of people on the left have been saying for a long time, that these kinds of policies do bankrupt the country. I think we're a nation that has become out of control with our addiction to war. And I think I really believe that the core of the problem is the campaign finance system in this country, where you have corporations now being recognized as having a, you know, right to free speech, and they're human beings. And of course, Russ Feingold is continuing to fight against all of that. But when you allow the war industry to pour cash into the campaign coffers of politicians, Democrat and Republican, they have no incentive to try to back off of these belligerent policies. They have every incentive to figure out a justification to be in Somalia, be in Pakistan, be in Afghanistan, and to greatly exaggerate the threat being posed by a largely decimated al-Qaeda organization. And so those are the questions that should be premier questions in these debates and in the campaign. I fear it's not going to be, though. But my God, look at how much money we spend on these wars. And to what end? Do they make us safer? What is it doing to our country? I think the caller raises very important questions that are resonating across political lines now in this country.
You also, in your very lengthy and thorough pieces, talk about a draft defense spending bill that authorizes more than $75 million in U.S. counterterrorism assistance aimed at fighting the Shabaab and al-Qaeda in Somalia, which it would appear from your articles were going about in completely the wrong fashion.
Right. And I was in Afghanistan recently also looking at prospects for the Taliban reconciling with other political elements within Afghanistan, and I think many Afghans want that. They recognize that the Taliban must have a role, as much as, you know, we may not like that. The Taliban are Afghans, and they are not foreigners. They're not al-Qaeda. They are their own entity. And the U.S. at every turn has sabotaged political processes that could result in some form of reconciliation because we're obsessed with the idea that the Taliban, you know, are equal to al-Qaeda. And it's just simply not true. As much as I think the Taliban are a reprehensible movement, nations have a right to self-determination as long as they're not threatening other nations. The same could be said of Somalia. The politics in Somalia are largely based around clans, tribes of people. And I don't mean tribe in the sense that someone's wandering a countryside. It is political, and it's also ethnic, and it's the only way that Somalia will be stabilized is if they find some common ground to unite on. And in Somalia, the best shot for it probably is Islam, is the religion. And it doesn't mean al-Qaeda. Somalia has a Sufi tradition, largely nonviolent. There is a lack of an Islamic radical history in Somalia except the last 10 years. We have helped to create that. So my point is, we have to be willing to back off of our rhetoric, our post-9/11 rhetoric, and say, what is the best shot we have to stabilize this country? And in both Afghanistan and Somalia, it almost certainly has to come from a combination of clan politics and religion.
Jeremy Scahill, our guest, will take a couple final phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Calvin Trillin, our guest, hour number two. Kate in Milwaukee. Hi, Kate.
Hi. I have a question. I watch your guest and Richard Engel whenever they come back to the States and report on their dangerous trips. And I've always wanted to ask this question. I'm curious whether your guest, or if he knows also whether Richard Engel, whether both of you, when you make these dangerous trips and then gather this information, when you come back, do you ever have a chance to talk to the president himself and relay your important, dangerous information and get his attention to take action?
I certainly, the only communications I have with the president is fundraising letters that I get sent like millions of other people in this country. I mean, and Richard Engel, I don't know. I mean, I know Rachel Maddow has met a number of times with President Obama, and you know, she's a friend of mine, and you know, and I think that that's probably our, in terms of, you know, more progressive media people that actually go places that have the ear of the president, probably Maddow's about as close as it gets. I do a lot of outreach to Congress, and I try to talk to representatives of both parties about these issues, and I've been invited to testify a few times in Congress, and I think there are some really great representatives that are working on these issues, but that's very different than having the ear of the president. And I think at the end of the day, to me, one of the most depressing aspects of where our nation has headed when it comes to foreign policy is that from Bush to Obama, there's been almost no change in our foreign policy. If anything, Obama has really amplified the role of covert forces from the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command. And we hear about it when Osama bin Laden is killed by Navy SEALs, but we don't hear about it when two pregnant women in Afghanistan are taken out in a botched night raid by those same forces. And I think that as Bush was surrounded by people who had a political agenda shaping policies around their political perspective, I think that President Obama has listened far too much to the dark side forces, people like General Petraeus and others, who believe that the world is full of nails that need a hammer to hit them, and we have unleashed this hammer all over the world, and it hits nails that weren't even sticking out, and sometimes the hammer is going to fly back and hit you in the face, and I'm very concerned about our foreign policy, but I only get fundraising letters from President Obama, never an invitation to brief him on anything.
Well, it would make sense because you are the other thing that you realize when you read your pieces is how few journalists are doing this kind of reporting. Because it is incredibly dangerous reporting. It's just nobody goes there. So you ought to be briefed.
To go to these places, I mean, you're going to spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 just to operate for a couple of weeks if you want to do it in any remotely safe way or respectably wise way. And who has that kind of money? I mean, I spend half my year, Kathleen, raising money for a few weeks of international travel because newsrooms are shutting down. No one wants to pay for it. We're all on Twitter all day and Facebook and blogging, and that's great, but that's not journalism.
That's not being there.
Journalism
exactly.
is going somewhere, asking tough questions and telling stories you wouldn't hear unless you went there.
Well, you sure do that. Jeremy, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thanks for all the work you do, too.
Well, it's nothing compared to what you do. Jeremy Scahill, who is from Milwaukee, we interviewed him first back in 2007 when his book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army was released. His current pieces are in The Nation. They are lengthy and they are extremely important pieces. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. We have Calvin Trilling coming up. Stay tuned.